Well, you know, by listening to the program over the years, that we have talked a lot about Planet X. Up next, Doug Elwell joins us with his thoughts on Planet X, the sign of the Son of Man, and the edge of the age. Stand by for that on Coast to Coast AM. Planet X, one of my favorite subjects, so get ready for this classic Coast to Coast. You know, by day, Doug Elwell works in the field of information technology as a freelance website developer. By night, he moonlights as a travel writer, focusing on mysterious and exotic travel destinations around the world. And Doug's second book, Planet X, The Sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age, reveals his hidden passion as an advanced theoretical theologist, focusing on retranslating the Bible in the light of the modern scientific advancements. And we're going to talk a lot about creation, end times, and how Planet X is involved in all of this. Here's Doug Elwell. Back in Coast to Coast, he was with us about 3 years ago. Doug, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, George. Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You know what? Just developing websites and focusing on mysterious and exotic places for travel, I could do a show on each one of those, by the way. You've got the greatest jobs in the world.
I wish, I've been able to combine many of my different passions into one with the mysterious world and with my book on Planet X. I've been able to build the websites and all the print collateral and do the writing and the editing. It was one of my, the Planet X book has been in production off and on for about 22 years once
wow.
I first read Sitchin and
college,
and I realized, you know, this is the answer to some of the questions I had. So I've been planning this book for some 22 years, and really Mysterious World was more of a side project until the time was ripe for the Planet X book to be launched.
Well, good for you, and I'm looking forward to this with you tonight. And you know, with the technology that we're involved in these days, are you finding more and more people are just developing websites? Has that plateaued? What's going on there?
It's becoming more complicated. There is a degree of automation, like Facebook, for example, is a classic example. Of people being able to publish their own work online, of course, blogging, which is actually being replaced largely by Facebook and things like Google Plus. But there is a degree of automation, but there's still a high need for developers and programmers like myself. So it's and the business is starting to pick up again. So it's
that's good.
I'm definitely in the right place.
That's good. And how does the internet support all the volumes of information that people keep pumping out? I mean, if a million people decided this week they want their own websites, can the internet support that?
The internet is really more of a concept almost than it is an actual physical entity. It's basically a series of connected computers that are connected over the telephone networks using a protocol called HTTP and other protocols. So really, the internet is sort of a self-producing and self-monitoring system, each with many, many individual nodes, like 1,000 points of light, all over the world. So it's really, the internet is really, it's more of a, something like a community project that's kind of constantly in motion. And the internet, there are such things as such as name servers that need to be updated by the centralized authority. And there are rules governing protocols that can be used and so forth. But generally speaking, it's pretty much still the Wild West out there.
I keep wondering, Doug, what will happen if the internet ever goes down worldwide? Chaos everywhere. I don't know how we would function.
Well, the internet's designed to not go down. It was the original point of it was a thing built by the military called an ARPANET.
DARPA, that's right.
Which is designed to withstand a nuclear attack and maintain communications by being decentralized. They set it up so if many different points on the network were taken out, they would still be able to communicate. So the internet is actually very unlikely to ever go down. Like I was saying, it's so decentralized and so kind of do-it-yourself that it's almost impossible to take it out unless you hit some of the central servers. And even then, there's lots of redundancy all over the system.
Probably the only way we wouldn't be able to use it is if our power goes out.
An EMP attack like we've been hearing might have a serious effect. But I suspect our main servers are hardened pretty effectively. So they are military in background and in use in some cases. So they have to make sure those things are running 24/7.
I'm sure, like I did, you picked up the 12th Planet, written by the late Zechariah Sitchin, many, many years ago, as you were saying. What effect did it have on you?
Well, Beck, I'll give you a brief story on my motivation for writing the book and why I read Sitchin when I was part of my research. Back in the late 1980s, I was concerned about the way things are going culturally, and I wanted to see if maybe Jesus was returning in my lifetime. So I began studying apocalyptic, the Bible, that related things, some ancient texts, the Apocrypha, and so forth. And I came across a mysterious passage in Matthew 24 where Jesus described his second coming that would be immediately preceded by a sign in the heavens. Now, I wasn't sure what they meant by that. Was it a star or some kind of heavenly spiritual
sign, anything, right?
Something, or junction of planets, who knows? And for some reason, I automatically linked it with the Star of Bethlehem event because that preceded his first coming, so I figured maybe his second coming would be the same or similar kind of setup. So I actually started studying the Star of Bethlehem, what was that supposed to be, and there's three main theories that I've discovered since then, that it's a comet, a conjunction of planets, or a supernova. But none of these fit the criteria described in Matthew 2 because comets are pretty transitory and usually not very bright and are pretty common. Conjunction of planets usually only last a couple of days, and the Magi who came from Persia would have taken probably at least 2 or 3 months to get there. And it was said they followed the star all the way from, you know, where they came from until it alighted over the manger in Bethlehem. So this particular sign, if it was the same as the Star of Bethlehem, it would have to be in appearance for at least 2 or 3 months and be very bright and outstanding and very unusual, because these Magi recognized Jesus as the king of the world or the king of the universe. That's a pretty big deal. You're not going to have some passing comet or a conjunction of planets, which happen every couple of centuries, inaugurating the king of the universe. And the other one, which was a supernova. Supernova don't really last that long either. And there's maybe one that was around that time, but it wasn't particularly spectacular. So I basically kind of run out of options. I was about to give up when I came across Sitchin's book, The 12th Planet, and realized I knew immediately when I opened it, this is it. And this is the answer I was looking for, and that's where this whole odyssey started.
I've had an opportunity to have introduced him at the various functions, and he was supposed to be on our show probably another last time, and he passed before he had an opportunity, Doug, to get on. And I missed the guy. He was tough. He was a tough guy, a little scrapper at 90 years old, but I remember one day on the air I asked him how old he was, and he went, "That's very rude." You know, in the way he does it. Or I was introducing him. He was getting a Lifetime Achievement Award, and I introduced him, and I said, here, please sit in this chair. And he went, "I'm standing." You know, so he was a toughie. But his theories about Planet X and what it was, I think, phenomenal. Now, there's some, and they've been on our show. Mike Heiser, one of them, he does not believe that Sitchin has it right. So you've got that camp out there, Doug, that just doesn't think there is that extra planet out there. I suspect there's something out there somewhere.
Well, when I did my research initially just to see is this worth following up on, even though Sitchin's book, it just filled me with a fire in the belly. I never lost. There was something deeply archetypal about what he wrote that was just so almost genetic for me. It was really just became a part of me. And I wanted to, you know, before I started off on something that may not prove to be fruitful, I wanted to double check his references to see where is he getting this information. Uh-huh. Is there really a Planet X, you know, and our astronomers talking about it? And I was pleasantly surprised to find that Planet X had actually been sought after by that time for about 100 years. The Percival Lowell first started looking for it, I think it was 1880s, 1890s, and when they were searching for outer planets beyond planet Uranus, they found Neptune, and the next planet out, they named Planet X. X simply meaning unknown, i.e. the unknown planet. So until they found it and were able to name it, they just called it Planet X. So it's not a mysterious kind of, you know, cheesy science fiction thing. It's a legitimate scientific endeavor. And I think people have a hard time getting over that. And I try to talk to them about this subject. When you hear Planet X, you think, oh, this is some science fiction film. It's a very real and legitimate course of study in astronomy, and it's been so for over 100 years.
Why do you think astronomers who can't find it are having a difficult time trying to spot it?
Planet X, I suspect, like many comets, is actually what is called a black body. That is, it's actually covered or obscured by a cloud of thick tar-like organic goo, which is actually found on many comets. By analyzing the spectra and studying comets, they actually have been able to detect simple proteins on the surfaces of these comets, and also sometimes on asteroids that fall. I suspect Planet X is much the same. It's basically like a comet, which, when there's no tail, i.e., when it's not, when it's farther away from Earth than the asteroid belt,
it's not lit up, nothing reflecting.
Yeah, they're actually as black as coal or blacker, with an albedo of equal to or less than 4%, which means they're effectively invisible to optical telescopes. However, when they come closer than the asteroid belt to the sun, they begin the process of sublimation. When the solar wind hits them and the patches of ice, water ice in our surfaces, that turns into vapor and then forms the comet tail. I suspect Planet X is much the same way, and this is kind of the secret. Planet X, when it returns, appears suddenly.
Like it sneaks up on you.
It sneaks up on you like a thief in the night.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it possible that there could be more than one of these planets out there?
Actually, there is. There have been many planets. There might have been many planets passing in and out of our solar system over time. In the early formation of our solar system, there was probably all kinds of chaos going on. Who knows what actually happened? So the Planet X, and my course and my studies of the mainstream science's view of Planet X, their original theory was that Planet X was causing observational errors in the movements of the planet Neptune, errors which have since been noted to be based on observational errors rather than actual gravitational pull of another planet. But the Planet X theory was greatly enhanced and brought back to life when the Voyager probes flew past planets Uranus and Neptune. And they found that they were in total disarray. Uranus is actually rotating on its side with the south pole pointing towards the sun half the time.
Caused by something out there, right?
Something very massive. They calculated it was something 3 to 5 times the mass of Earth. Must have passed very near this planet and pulled it over, possibly impacted it, either or with one of its satellites, turning Uranus, which is a very good-sized planet, literally on its side. It's like this giant bowling ball just bowled through the outer solar system and knocked the planets over on their sides.
What is your theory, your specific theory about Planet X?
My theory about Planet X is basically aligned with that of mainstream astronomy, in that, except that instead of the typical astronomical approach, astronomers view that it's orbital period of about maybe 1,000 years, and it goes in and out of our outer solar system only. And mine's kind of a combination of the mainstream theory plus Sitchin's view, in that the orbital period is actually about 2,000 years, and it takes it into the inner solar system where its inner part of the perihelion of its orbit, the place where it comes closest to the sun, is actually in the asteroid belt and not somewhere out near Uranus. So that's actually much closer to what Sitchin said, and it makes a lot of sense because if Planet X came in that close, it would explain why there's a field of rubble out there in asteroids, because it probably conflicted with the planet that used to be there and moved it to a different position. And I believe we can discuss this. This is actually reflected in the book of Genesis.
That's fascinating. Now, how would people know that unless they were told it?
They wouldn't. The problem is a lot of people are kind of stuck in their positions. They're either creationists, fundamentalists, where the universe was created in 6 literal solar days, or you're a heretic. And the other side, where it's just a bunch of, nonsense, and the universe has been around forever, and there is no God, and there's science is king. And there's no in-between, because the people are afraid to get in between the two opposing forces, because like any civilian in a war, the civilians usually get the worst of it. So people tend to stay out of the middle and let the two sides fight it out. I'm not afraid of controversy, obviously, writing for a mysterious world. It's just, I think I actually kind of enjoy it. I'm that kind of personality. So I get fundamentalists saying this is totally wrong when they review my book on Amazon. And I get scientific people saying, you know, it's just, this is, you know, it's nonsense. It's not good science. And you get, you know, pro-Sessionite people say this has got too much Christian material in it and so forth. So everyone has something positive to say about it or something negative.
That happens. Don't let it bother you.
Oh, I don't. I'm sure you get plenty of abuse on your books too. So
same thing. There are a lot of little haters out there. You know, you can disagree without having to put somebody down, and people need to learn that. Why is there this? And I wouldn't call it obsession, but there's this massive interest in trying to find out if there is that planet out there. How come?
I think, like I was saying before, there's kind of a fundamental genetic, something in our DNA that says that there's something out there that's greater than ourselves, and it's important, and it was part of the history of mankind, a fundamental part of it. Planet X, in my studies, seems to come by every 2,000 years during major changes in Earth history and upheavals in human culture. For example, 2,000 years ago, you had the birth of Christianity, literally the birth of Christ. 2,000 years before that, you had the destruction of the Empire of Sumer, which was effectively similar to the downfall of the United States. I mean, Sumer was the empire of the age, even greater than Egypt in some ways. And the Sumerian Empire was actually overthrown by, in their own histories, they described their god Enlil, appeared in the heavens and threw down fire upon them, a fiery spear which destroyed their country.
Sounds like a missile to me, doesn't it?
A missile
or a laser beam or something.
I believe what happened was, I think back in the late 1980s, there was a very large meteor crater discovered in southeastern Iraq in the marshy area there, and which would have made sense because that was near the city of Ur, which was the capital of Sumer, which was destroyed by this fire of heaven. And they believe it happened somewhere between 2000 and 3000 BC. I place it around between 1900 and 2000 BC, that this meteorite struck Sumer and basically destroyed it and weakened it so badly that it never recovered. It was eventually conquered by Babylonians, who then put together all of the old texts of the Sumerians and assembled what we know now as the Nu-Mailish or the Babylonian creation epic, which Sitchin used as his reference point for writing the 12th planet.
What are the odds of something like that happening in that region, which was the cradle of civilization?
It does seem unlikely, but because to strike near Ur would be kind of like a meteorite striking within 10 miles of Washington. It's pretty unlikely. That's why they felt that they'd been judged by the gods, because it was so devastating and such a precise hit by such a large asteroid. It was interesting to note that they said Enlil actually appeared in heaven. Now, Enlil was the precursor to Marduk, the Babylonian deity. Enlil was the deity of the Sumerian-Akkadian mixed race, who in turn had superseded Anu of the Sumerians. And all three of those were, in Sitchin's paradigm, and I agree with him, were all designations for Planet X, which appeared in the heavens every 2,000 years or so. And since it passed through the asteroid belt, it would usually throw asteroids everywhere. And some of those would hit Earth and cause cataclysms. And this is why you had, actually, the Sumerians who got it right, their god Enlil, the planet, appeared in the heavens again, as it does every 2,000 years.
All right, Doug, we're going to come back after this quick break, and we're, you know, check in with you about more of Planet X on Coast to Coast AM. Doug Elwell, our special guest tonight. We shall be right back. Well, for less than 25 cents a day, you can become a Coast Insider, become part of the Coast Club. Just simply go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, sign up for it, and have some fun, real fun. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest tonight, Doug Elwell, his book, Planet X, The Sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age, with us on Coast to Coast AM. Doug, part of Zechariah Sitchin's theory on Planet X, of course, was that it brought the Anunnaki, its inhabitants, with them. What do you think of that, the fact that there were extraterrestrials involved here?
It's interesting that in the Nume Elish, the Marduk appears to be linked with the Anunnaki and another group of divine beings called the Ajiji, which comprise the divine assembly in the Babylonian mythos. And these both got together to create a stage tower of Babylon, probably the Tower of Babel described in the Bible. It's also described in Nume Elish. It's specifically used to worship Marduk and to track its movements. And the Nume Elish actually describes Marduk as a star that moves, i.e. as a planet. So it's explicitly noted that Marduk is actually a planet. And it seems that possibly this planet may be some sort of a staging ground or even a throne for these deities, a place, even a different kingdom altogether than the kingdom of this world. And it may be that whenever Planet X comes around, some of these beings are thrown down from that kingdom and are forced to live on Earth because they're no longer worthy to live on this planet. I've looked in my studies of the Bible, it would seem that Planet X might be somehow related to the throne of God itself, as possibly some sort of a traveling throne chariot that moves through the heavens. Isaiah talks about how God moves through the heavens in a circle. Actually, I believe it's Isaiah 51. And it appears every once in a while, every 2,000 years or so, there's kind of an intermixing of humanity with these divine beings, and you get the offspring being the giants. This happened around 2000 B.C., the time of Abraham, and what God told Abraham to not go to Canaan because what was going on was called something called the iniquity of the Amorites, which they were going after strange flesh, and some scholars believe that they've been interbreeding with the fallen angels once again, just mm-hmm. as they had before the flood. And the giants are being recreated, these fallen angels being what we would call maybe space aliens or whatever.
Maybe so. Right.
It. And so these beings came down from heaven to earth, or more likely thrown down, and began interbreeding with mankind, and you get the giants again. Every once in a while this happens.
What if Planet X was, what if Earth was like a prison planet to all these planets out there, and that they dumped them here, like fallen angels, that's what they call them, and they just dumped them on the planet?
I do think you're correct. I do think of it in those terms. It's not the Alex Jones type of prison planet where we're stuck.
Right.
Even though we kind of are. But I do believe this is kind of a dumping ground for these refuse, and we human beings are kind of the jail wardens to kind of keep things, you know, going. I think Adam was probably the original warden.
Or inmate.
or inmate, or both. But I think his original task was to keep these fallen angels down. I suspect there's been an ongoing cosmic war for who knows how many thousands or millions of years, and God has been gradually pushing and collecting these beings and putting them on this planet. And mankind, part of the reason for his creation was to kind of keep an eye on these beings until they could all be collected and finally sentenced. But Satan managed to bribe Adam and Eve and escape his jail, and their sin entered the world as a result.
Do you believe that astronomers today, maybe quietly, are looking for this planet?
I believe that is possible. I don't like to get too much into conspiracy theory, but if you think about it, such a planet in our solar system could represent an existential threat to peace and security of all nations, not just the United States. Like I mentioned with ancient Sumer, it was obliterated by an asteroid, probably launched from the asteroid belt by this planet, because it would disturb a lot of asteroids as it passes through the asteroid belt, and there's a good chance we'd be hit by one or more of them. So if it presents any kind of threat to national security, either our country or any country, it's probably going to be kept under wraps until it could be released in a sort of a disclosure event, like the aliens and so forth, which might be tied into Planet X. In fact, it might be all part of the same matrix.
Sure,
so
that could be.
I wouldn't expect them to release anything unless it was in their best interest to do so, not ours.
Yeah, I'm convinced. For example, if they knew an asteroid was coming this way, they're not going to tell us. They'd rather let it hit because it would create undue panic. I mean, look at this little satellite that's supposed to come down on Friday. I mean, you got a lot of people talking about that.
I heard there was about 20 or 30 different pieces which are going to land in various points.
Yeah.
The odds of being hit are 1 in 3,600, which apparently is good, which it doesn't sound very good, but it is.
If you're, unless you're one of those 1 in 3,600s.
Yeah, that's actually pretty high when you think about it. It's not like Skylab back in the 70s.
That's right.
Junk. It's coming down in many large pieces on which may hit cities. So I recently heard about an asteroid. Actually, it was a camera lens that fell from the sky and almost killed somebody in their house.
I heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, and that once a small object gets some momentum, it can kill you pretty effectively.
Yeah, it sure could. A little pebble could go right through your head.
If it's a sufficient velocity, it would do that.
Now, back to this search for Planet X. You tied it into the creation, the second coming. Tell me more about that.
Planet X, in my belief, is actually, it is not only in the Bible, it is fundamental to the Bible. It is the outer parameters of the beginning and ending. Jesus himself said, I am the bright and morning star, not once but twice in the book of Revelation in chapters 2 and 22, associating himself with this star. He says, in Matthew 24, he says, the sign of my second coming will immediately precede me in the heavens. And, of course, the star of Bethlehem preceded his birth. So consistently he's associated with this star and a return of this star. And in people who study these sorts of things note, myth, in the concepts that are used, this sort of a God versus the dragon battle motif, which I call the divine conflict creation motif, which is actually a theological approach that's been around for about 100 years, first put forward by a German theologian named Hermann Gunkel, about how they noted in the creation material in the Old Testament and also in the material in the book of Revelation, there appears to be a consistent theme of God battling a dragon, variously called Rahab or Leviathan, mm-hmm. or simply Tanin.
Symbolism for something?
It's symbolic of, in Enumelation, it's the same thing. Marduk versus Tiamat. Tiamat is the sea dragon who symbolizes the earth. And the people who, when we first discovered Enumelation in the old tablets in Ashurbanipal, I think it was Nineveh, theologians noted the very distinct similarities between some of the creation passages in the Bible, such as Psalm 74, Isaiah 51, and Job 9, and actually a number of other places, which I tried to read in my retranslations of Job. Job is actually chock full of cognates to Enumelation. It's unbelievable, so much that I actually call it the Hebrew version of the Hebrew creation epic, parallel to Enumelation. The creation and the end times appear to be linked conceptually as being a conflict between God and a dragon. And Isaiah says in, I think it's 29:1 or 27:1, at the end times, God will battle Leviathan again and put him down for good. And the exact quote was, in that day, the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. This is a consistent theme throughout the Old Testament, and particularly in the creation material and in the end times. And this also shows up in the Enumelish, where the dragon is equated with earth, and the warrior deity, in this case Marduk, was equated with some other star or planet in the heavens. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that there's something going on here. They conceptually thought of a battle between two planets being closely linked to the creation and the end times, both in the Bible and other apocalyptic and the creation literature of the ancient Near East.
Why did they always bury things, Doug, in symbolism and in parables? And, they talked about things from the sky, like, Ezekiel's chariot, which to me sounds like it could have been a craft of some type. Why did they?
I believe it was a craft, actually. Yeah. I want to write an article about that. Actually, my next book about the giants, which will come out sometime next year.
All right, we'll talk a little bit about that, too, because it's all tied together, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But, I mean, why weren't they direct? I mean, was this because they didn't understand it? They had to at least put some kind of feeling slogan about it?
It's the symbolism is easy for people to remember because, remember, a lot of these people were not well-educated. And scientifically complicated terminology would lose meaning over time, but if you couch it in terms of a battle between God and some sort of a monster, a dragon in this case, it's easier for people to remember. It's interesting. And since this was part of their New Year's festival, the Babylonians would recite this every single year as part of the New Year's festival. They wanted to put it forth as a sort of a narrative, a story, which was interesting and people could understand. If they described the battle as between this planet had an orbital period of 2,000 years, and nobody's going to know what they're talking about. So they kept it simple. And the simpler you keep a communication, the more longer it is, easier, more likely it is to last over long periods of time, because it could be more easily remembered. And in ancient times, these things were not actually written down a lot of times. They were actually orally transmitted.
From one to the other, right?
Yeah. Right. You know, a lot of Plato's work, for example, they actually had to sing every single word of that. There was a song behind it. For example, the dialogues in which we hear about Atlantis, that was actually a song that was sung.
So people would remember it.
English. They were, yeah, it's easy to remember if you know the tune. You still do this today. You put things to tunes, you remember it. It was called a mnemonic, a means of memorizing things. And the Enumeration was like this, and Job was also like this too. The Book of Job, at the beginning, both God and Satan are described as singing the words that they were saying. So Job was probably also, it's kind of like an opera in that sense, as was Enumeration, as was any theogony or story of the creation. These were all songs that were sung by the priests at the New Year's festivals to remember the creation battle between the high god of their pantheon and a dragon. And this concept was ubiquitous throughout the ancient Near East, ancient Canaan, Egypt, Syria, Babylon, Persia. They all had conflict between the high deity of their pantheon and a dragon, resulting in the creation of the earth as we currently know. They all believe that. It was ubiquitous, and it was also in the Bible very, very strongly. But most people, since it's not overtly described in the book of Genesis as having a dragon, even though the word Tiamat shows up as the word Tihom, which is translated as deep sea.
Doug, tell me about the involvement with the planet X and giants. Why the tie-in?
The giants, the Nephilim and the Anunnaki and the Babylonian mythos apparently came down from this planet, which came towards Earth and interacted with it. And every time this planet apparently comes near Earth again, they'd come down again and begin rebreeding the giants. Exactly what things are like in Planet X, is there some ancient civilization, high alien civilization, or what's going on there? It's unclear. But it would appear that every time this planet appears, the fallen angels come down, or the aliens come down, or whatever you want to call them.
Right.
And started interbreeding with mankind and creating the giants. Probably, my guess is, generically speaking, since these fallen angels are at war with God, that they come down to try to raise an army that they can raise to try to attack heaven again and retake Planet X, possibly, away from God himself. That's my theory, is that the reason for creating the giants was to create an army that they could use to attack heaven itself. And in the Greek myths, this is actually described as there's a myth called the Gigantomachy, the War of the Giants, in which the giants actually attacked heaven by throwing huge rocks up at the gods, Zeus and the other Olympians. So there is, and of course this happened in the Book of Enoch, and it's alluded to in the Book of Genesis, but not actually stated.
What about hard evidence that we know something strange happens when this planet comes around? Could you throw the flood of Noah into that?
The flood of Noah was probably caused by a passing of Planet X, because it would require either that, or maybe just simply a comet or two might have hit our atmosphere and dumped a huge amount of water into our hydrosphere, or a number of asteroids may have hit the oceans, caused huge tidal waves, which would cover the continents and so forth, causing.
So one big one would do that.
One would do the job for most of the Earth. But Planet X, like I said earlier, when it passes through the asteroid belt, it sends a lot of asteroids every which way. And the odds of us having a cataclysm during that period are much higher. Therefore, it's more likely that the great cataclysmic events of our history may have been caused by the passing of this planet, which tends to stir things up and create the downfall of civilizations and the rising up of new ones.
How many civilizations allude to something like this, Doug, a Planet X?
The creation myths, if we were to take them at face value, if we were to take mythology at face value and actually think this is literally true and not something they just made up, It would seem that most of the ancient Near Eastern cultures, and maybe some of the European ones, like the Nordic cultures, they all featured a battle between the high deities of their high gods of their pantheons and this dragon creature, resulting in the creation of the earth. And this shows up also in the Nordic myths, the end time battle between Thor and the dragon Jormungand, who is believed to circle the entire world around its equator. It's so huge. And Thor's battle with the Jormungand will actually result in the destruction of the earth, I believe, and a great cataclysm. So in these ancient myths, both the beginning and the end times are associated with a conflict between a battle between God and a dragon. And I think, and typically, as I described in my book, Chapter 2, it goes into, it's called The Astronomic Religions of the Ancient Near East, and how the ancient world, every culture worshipped the planets as gods, and these planets were considered to be the thrones of these deities.
Was it merely because they could see these things in the heavens and thought, you know, it must be godly? Or did something actually happen?
I'm thinking that not only that they were these things, they called them the planets from the Greek planetes, which means wanderers. These things were out of the control, and they seemed to have a life of their own because they moved in the heavens. But also, these records state that occasionally divine beings came down from these planets and gave them knowledge of writing, architecture, music, mathematics, astronomy. Now, this happened in the Sumerian and Babylonian myths and other mythologies.
And if it didn't happen, would they make that up? I don't think so.
No, it would make a little sense for them to make it up.
Right.
These people are not.
They're not creative writers.
No, this is their fundamental belief system. You don't just make something up. This is their experience, and they wrote it down, put it on clay tablets, made a part of the oral history, and so forth. And it's passed down as sort of a crude form to us that seems nonsensical or even impossible. But this is what we have, and we have similar accounts in the Bible. And if we believe these alien encounters, maybe similar events happening today.
Well, maybe so. Maybe so indeed. Now, back to the giants. Are they gone from this planet now?
The giants tend to be wiped out, and once they're formed, there's usually a huge war between the giants and/or between God and the giants, or both, typically both. In the Book of Enoch, the world before the flood, God told the archangels to set the giants at war against each other, so they would weaken and each other prior to God's final attack on them. And they then told the fallen angels to hurl huge rocks down on top of them, and of course also the fallen angels who gave birth to them. This happened again in around 2000 BC during the time of Abraham, when the iniquity of the Amorites was coming to the full again. The giants were in the land of Canaan. God raised up Israel and trained them to attack the giants again, lest the giants rampage all over the earth and exterminate mankind, as they almost did in the world before the flood, because the giants were vicious and bloodthirsty and merciless beings who were designed specifically to kill everyone who was not a giant. So this was Satan's attempt to wipe out Homo sapiens man, the way God had created man, and replace him with his own form of man, which I call in my Giants articles in Mysterious World, Homo artificialis, artificially manufactured mankind.
I want to talk with you about what you think governments know, Doug, when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.